Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and we are carrying on our journey through South America as we venture into the South American files, the cities, and it's part three. And I'm delighted to say that I've not had to practice the pronunciation, which is what usually happens before we press record. We're just going to Bogota. And that's it. It's as simple as that. That's where we're heading for episode three. First of all, usual co-host and curator of series, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, Stu. Yeah, we're going to a city that we all heard of, but there's lots of football that football clubs are going to find out more about as we go through the episode. I don't dare for a moment.
Yeah, but when we first started this with episode one, we were like, yeah, 45 minutes, we should get 45 minutes from it. And an hour and 15 later, we were like, oh, okay, yeah, we got more than we thought. So I'm going to say that should be no problem in this episode.
I'm sure you're right, buddy. I'm sure you're right.
And second co-host, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome. Before we came on, we were just chatting about the lateness of last night's podcast.
Yeah, this is somewhat extreme podcasting, I think we can call this. We've broken the all of the matrix, I think, with last night's effort, which was just like the most epic thing, you know, I think we've ever encountered.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, and for context, it's you know, I think you listeners would have heard this maybe a couple of months ago, maybe by the time this one comes out. It was a podcast we did with Paul Power, the former Manchester City captain, Everton. Legend, really. You'd have to call him there. Who was just so fantastically open about every aspect of his career. And it was just the most stunning, best part of 3 hours that we've ever recorded, I think. So much so that we're going to have to break it into two podcasts, aren't we?
It absolutely is. I feel like the Michael Aspel telethon from the late 80s, but the podcast version
that's nuts. I don't know why, but that television program sprung to my mind not all that long ago, and I can't even remember what it was in relation to now. And it was one of those that I think it crossed my mind, and I thought, if I mentioned this program to people would be like, that never happened. That never happened. Whatever the 36-hour television program that ITV used to do every year or so.
Yeah, I remember it clear. I remember it clear as day. And in fact, I felt like I was a part of it last night. But it was brilliant. His battery was blinking on his laptop, and Mrs. Power
and Mrs. Power was demanding that it was bedtime.
Yeah, it was the only reason why it stopped. But So, but anyway, we're back at it.
We're back for more. Nothing better to come back to, though. This is just outstanding to come back to.
It is. And obviously, I would say, where would we be? Quite clearly, we'd just be in our houses. We wouldn't be anywhere near Bogota. But where would we be without the expertise of our resident special guest, Mr. Pete Watson? Pete, welcome.
Evening, guys. I feel like there's almost a challenge being laid to see if we can kind of outdo it today, you know. I mean, I've written a thesis about Colombian football, so if we want to go through that page by page and just deal with Bogota on the way through, we can go till morning, lads. You know, I'm happy.
It was no word of a liar. It was brilliant. It was brilliant to listen to, but yeah, it was unbelievable. Unbelievably long, but a great listen. Pete, you chat for as long as you want. We're always just happy to listen and learn. Don't you worry about that. And I guess we're at a place, Pete, where, and I'm not trying to be, prejudiced in any way, but this is one of those cities when it's first mentioned, you think of Bogota. Football is not necessarily the first thing that springs to mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, I think that's the case with Colombia more generally. I think that Bogota, in lots of ways, you know, it kind of is the city that's more known of Colombia, possibly. Medellin, though, is the really notorious one. I think that Bogota doesn't have the same kind of reputation for, you know, huge criminality, for cartel influence, like Medellin does. It was often, unfortunately, the site of some of the atrocities of the cartel war of the 80s and 90s. some of them linked to football. I mean, we could talk about, for example, the assassination of the Justice Minister, Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, back in the early 80s, who, you know, a year previously had accused a lot of the football clubs in the country, among them two of the major Bogota clubs, I'm sure will be the focus of a lot today, of having links with drug cartels. You know, and a year later, he was gunned down by men linked to Pablo Escobar. Bogota has been the site of violence. It's been the site of football violence between the Barras Bravas, the fan groups, the organised fan groups of two of the major clubs, Independiente Santa Fe and Millonarios. So it's been the site of that as well. I think in terms of football, you know, in lots of ways, Bogota is unusual in terms of South American capitals for almost not really being the most important, you know, site of the nation's football. I mean, a few things come to mind here that are probably worth saying at the outset. You know, that Colombia doesn't really play its international games in Bogota. They play in Barranquilla, you know, which is the Caribbean city. It's got the advantage of being on the coast, of being more tropical, humid, probably harder to play in. So Bogota is not the site of the games. For a long time, the National Football Association wasn't in Bogota. Again, it was in Barranquilla. So Bogota in lots of ways isn't the footballing powerhouse. It is a centre of footballing strength. But for example, if you look through the list and start, you know, like in a lot of capitals, you can point to so many footballers that, you know, that came from Buenos Aires or came from Asunción in week one or we'll carry on with that trend. In Bogota, there are very, very few, you know, there are very few major footballers who we would all know, you know, who come from the city, you know. So Bogota is, it's the site of a couple of teams. It's the site of a lot of interesting stories about Colombian football. But in many ways, you know, it's possibly not the real kind of footballing centre of the country. I think that in lots of ways, Barranquilla, Cali and Medellin could really strike as just as much of a claim to be, you know, the real heart of Colombian football.
It strikes me, Gary, you know, we talk about this all the time in terms of culture and society and all those things. And it's certainly something we get into whenever we're doing podcasts with Pete. But I guess when you look at Colombia, and I suppose you can make a case for any city in any football-loving country, but this certainly seems to be, or Colombian cities certainly seem to have an incredibly close relationship with football and what is going on in the country. It seems to permeate football at every level in Colombia.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, fascinating to hear what Pete just said there, you know. I mean, in the first two or three minutes of this podcast, I learned something I didn't know. I didn't know that Colombia didn't play the international games in the capital and that the Colombian affair wasn't based in the capital. But, you know, I hear what you're saying about the clubs there. And although, you know, when we get to talk about the individual clubs in Bogota, well, when Pete just gets to tell us about them, there's certainly one club there that I've been aware of beforehand for a number of reasons. And yet, doing a little bit of research this morning, apparently it's not even the most successful club in Bogota. And there's kind of some surveys been recently, and apparently there's a couple of clubs in Bogota that were ranked in the top 10 or top 20 clubs in the world, and one that was ranked seventh, so the top South American club I'd never even heard of. So this is going to be sort of a fascinating podcast, and you know, as you said, Stu, I mean, these that sort of thing, I'm sure, going to be repeated yet again as we go through the podcast, mate.
It, absolutely, you know, and again, like you say, I'm sure we're going to learn an awful lot, and I suppose, Stephen, as well, the other thing before we get into this, and I guess we touched on it a little bit when we did the South America files and the countries, but Colombian football, when you think of Brazil, you think of Uruguay, and you think of Argentina, you know, the club sides there are very well known. They're a part of, you know, European fans associate as part of the fabric of football in those countries. But for Colombia, and certainly for me, it's all very much about the national team and not about the football at club level.
Yes, I think certainly in contemporary terms, it's hard to put some kind of, you know, landscape, a familiar landscape to be able to chart it, to be able to put some signposts up. You know, going back, if you know your football history, then yes, you can lean to the El Dorado era. You know, a lot of us will know that Alfredo Di Stefano played there, you know, in the 50s before going to Real Madrid. So, you know, there'll be something, and the exodus of European players, the fact that, you know, even some very significant British players went to play over there. You know, I think that's probably something that either you know of, but maybe don't know in depth, or you don't know at all, and you're suddenly surprised by it. So I think, you know, there is that history there, but I think in contemporary terms, it's, you know, there's no comparison to other cities in other, you know, South American playing nations.
And I mean, I suppose, like, you know, like we say, Pete, we have our sort of format, you know, sort of our loose topics for this. But I'm sure that the culture and the social aspects, you know, we will probably tend to veer off a little bit, as you've already done. Sort of in the introductions, you know, we've not really come across assassinations yet, but yeah, we did a couple of minutes in this one. So I am sure we'll sort of veer off, but I guess to begin with then, it's, you know, to sort of set the scene, where we're looking at the main clubs in Bogota.
Yeah, so again, like compared to some of the cities we've talked about previously in Asunción and Avellaneda, which had clubs that are there at very much the origins of the league structures. The major Colombian football clubs that exist nowadays, which are Independiente Santa Fe and Millonarios, the two major clubs, aren't clubs that are formed at the same time we've been talking about with Olimpia or with Cerro Porteño or with, you know, Racing or Independiente. They're founded much later. There are clubs that play, you know, football again, but in Colombia, really, we're looking at two founding areas of football. We're looking in Bogota anyway. We're looking at a lot of the schools. And we're actually looking at the military school in 1892. One fascinating fact, which I'm just going to drop in for, this is really random, but isn't this cool, is that football was brought into Colombia by a guy called Henry Rowan Lemley, who was an American colonel. He was the first person to bring it into Bogota. It was long thought that it was British sailors and British people in the Caribbean coast in Barranquilla and Santa Marta. But Henry Rowan Lemley seems to be the first one. And what makes him really interesting is that he happened to be been fighting in the Sioux Wars in the 1860s and 70s, was actually present when the kind of great famous Sioux chief Crazy Horse was killed. So the same guy that was there when he died was responsible for the introduction of football in Colombia. So there's your random fact for the podcast. But you know, a lot of the football starts in schools, and the clubs that we're going to talk about a lot tonight, Santa Fe and Millonarios, are both founded from some of the elite schools in the country. So these are again elites, but Colombian elites that are founding them. There had been links before. There was a club that was linked to or a school side which became very famous, Bartolino. They were the first tight side to tour around into Medellin. And so, and into Bucaramanga. But a lot of these clubs fall by the wayside. And Santa Fe and Millonarios both emerge really in the kind of 1930s. They're playing in amateur local competitions. Colombia is quite interesting because it's a very disconnected country. A lot of the cities don't really connect and meet each other very often. So the football that is played is very regional based, and it's all amateur for a long time. So Millonarios Santa Fe are formed in a cafe. They take their name from the street in which the cafe is. Millonarios go through various names. They're called Unión Juventud, Unión Bogotana, Juventud Bogotana, Club Municipal de Deportes, when they actually become like the official club of Bogota for a while. Then they're disconnected and become Municipal Deportivo Independiente, the independent municipal sports club. And then what happens with Millonarios anyway is that they're kind of successfully linked with various businessmen, and they sign three Argentinians, which is a little bit kind of wrong because it's an amateur league, but they contract three Argentinians, and these three Argentinians play in a match. And a newspaper columnist called Luis Camacho Montoya mocks this. You know, he says, look, it's awful that, you know, the team that was the Gaishun, the Municipio, are now the Millonarios. And it, and actually that kind of name begin actually sticks. You know, they kind of quite like it, but also quite its nickname. It's also linked to River Plate, who were also known as the Millonarios for a while in the 1930s in Argentina. So these two clubs, particularly Santa Fe, formed from school pupils and then linked to a university, and Millonarios are doing very well. They're linked to very well-off families in the clubs. They're quite well-funded. They start dominating the local leagues, and they become some of the clubs that are really pushing to start the Colombian Professional League. Bearing in mind, again, this is there's very little contact between cities, certainly very little organised contact. In 1948, we have the first Colombian Professional League founded. Another Bogota club becomes professional at that time. That's linked to the Universidad de Bogota. That's not a club that lasts very long. They have a bit of a checkered history. They play actually the very first match of the Colombian Professional League, and they lose it. They also are responsible for or the wrong end of one of the greatest thrashings of the Colombian Football League, losing 12-1 to a Samarios team, who were actually comprised of a lot of Hungarian players who were touring the country and then ended up staying in Colombia and joining the Professional League. And then they disappear in 1953, which is the first of a long period of clubs that have kind of come in Bogota, either disappeared or gone on to other clubs. It's worth mentioning a couple of other clubs now then that are also playing Bogota. One of the ones that has managed to stick around is a club called Equidad. They're probably the third Colombian team. They've had a little bit of success nationally, and you know, they've done reasonably well in the Copa Sudamericana as well. After that, I mean, this is maybe something we could touch on is you know, at some point during this episode, is the kind of franchise system. There are a huge amount of clubs who have appeared, played in Bogota or Soacha or somewhere nearby, been there for a year or two and then moved somewhere else or sold their kind of their franchise to another Colombian city. A great example of this is Tigres. They're currently in the second division. But Tigres, again, it's trying to see if I can get the whole of the of their kind of trajectory. They started in Jamundí, which is a city in Cali, a city near Cali or a town near Cali, which is in kind of like the southern part of Colombia. They then moved to Palmira, which is a city quite near Cali. They changed their name to Expreso Palmira. Then in 2002, they moved to Cartagena, which is on the Colombian north coast. Then they moved to, they changed their name again then and were called Expreso Rojo, the Red Express. They then moved to Sincelejo and then back to Cartagena. Then they moved to Fusagasuga, which I'm glad there isn't a kind of like major footballing city in Colombia because I think Stu would struggle with that one. That is actually in Cundinamarca, the region where Bogota is, at least. So they were kind of getting close to Bogota. They played for a year or two in Zipaquira, then moved back to Fusagasuga, then to Soacha, which is kind of like on the outskirts of Bogota. And then they moved to Bogota properly, became called Tigres, renamed that in 2016, gained promotion and then got relegated after a year. So, but that's quite common. There are a lot of clubs like that who appear in Bogota for a little bit, try and put down roots, fail, disappear, get flogged off and so on. So I think really the main clubs we probably can talk about are Independiente Santa Fe, Millonarios and probably Equidad, with all kinds of random incarnations of other clubs kind of coming and going and appearing and disappearing throughout the kind of last couple of decades.
All right. So first of all, well done on the pronunciations, Pete. They're coming along a treat. excellent by you. Well done. The practice is really paying off. but in all seriousness, I mean, Gary, this is, like I say, you know, I know we say it all the time, but it's even we could end this episode right now, having learned 99% more of than what I already knew. It's like I say, it just seems like a fascinating country. It was fascinating when we did it, like I say, when we did the South American files, we did the countries, and it Colombia seems to me to feel like an outlier in the South Americas for its relationship with football. Not that it doesn't have a relationship, not that it doesn't have a positive relationship, but it just doesn't seem to fit anywhere with anything. This whole, so you know, as Pete was talking about there, the franchise, it just seems to be the most almost bonkers way to have a domestic football scene. And yet, when you think about Colombia, then I suppose you could argue it's the only type of football scene it could have.
Good point, yeah. You're right. I mean, you know, as Pete mentioned, you know, there's the two major clubs of Santa Fe and Leoneros. And I love the nickname, and Pete mentioned the other club there, Equidad. They were actually nicknamed, apparently, the insurance team. I mean, that's great. And when we get to pick the team at the end of them, I ain't giving anything away, but that's probably where I'm going, because I just think that's great. You know, I mean, they're not the Red Devils or the, you know, the, I don't know, the Blue Knights. It's the insurance team. I mean, great. But yet, I mean, doing the research this morning, you know, I looked up and obviously found the two big teams first, but I found this Tigres club. I was going through, I thought, is this a joke? I mean, every year since 2000, they seem to have moved and renamed themselves. And you know, if fans of Wimbledon were irritated by them, their club being sort of moved to Milton Keynes, any fans of this club, I mean, not only did they move, they changed the names as often as changed my socks. And you know, it's a fairly. I mean, I don't know whether we're going to find that this is a sort of common practice. Some clubs in different South American countries, but it just seems such a strange thing compared to the English league and you know what we're used to. You know, these two solid big clubs in Bogota, Leoneros and Independiente Santa Fe, and then everything seems to sort of be a little bit weird beneath that level. I mean, even the Equidad, I think they were only formed in 1982, I think they were formed. Is that right, Pete? You're on mute, Pete.
They weren't professional in 1982. That was their kind of amateur team. But then I think they didn't even enter the league until the early 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems everything seems so weird. Below that top level, those two major clubs, you know, I mean, certainly major in Bogota. Everything below that seems awfully weird. Very Colombian-esque, shall we say.
I do think that the more I was trying to frame the question, it was going through my head that it actually makes perfect sense. The fact it makes no sense makes a lot of sense. Stephen, and I don't know whether there's a connection here. I mean, obviously, I'm sure it's coincidence that Pete mentioned the American colonel who brings the game to Bogota, The franchise system just reminds me of US sport and how they pick up their franchises and move them places. And, you know, certainly, I don't know if you ever watched American football as a kid, but if it is, you'll certainly know the Los Angeles Raiders and then how they just get moved out of Los Angeles. And
yep.
And that, as Pete was talking there, that was the first thing that sort of popped in my head, this picking up of sports clubs. And, you know, and Gary mentioned it as well, you know, if you're a Wimbledon fan, how outraged you were. But if you were a sort of a Los Angeles Raiders fan, or if you were a fan of one of these clubs who appears at, you know, in Bogota in your childhood and you start to form a relationship and then they just go again. Again, it's something that I can't get my head around. But yeah, in other countries, it seems perfectly, perfectly acceptable and normal.
Yes, I know, I'm with you on that, Stu. I've never, ever been able to, because, I mean, we see our sport as being so intrinsic and rooted within communities and being part of the fabric of a town or a city or a village or whatever it is. And to see teams uprooted and shifted has always been wild. And yes, LA, you know, I grew up on Channel 4's coverage of American football.
Yeah,
and before that, on World of Sport, I can remember World of Sport showing it during the summer, and you didn't know that it had been played months before. I can remember, I can remember kind of like, you know, tagging on to the LA, the Raiders, and that shift from Oakland to LA and then back again, and then even kind of like, you know, the Rams went to St. Louis for a bit before going back, and now I think the Chargers are there, and I just thought, oh, can't get your head around it, because like, how does that even work? You know, where do you place your support there when you've had three different teams drift through the same city? You know, it's absolutely nuts. So yes, to see this in Colombian football, yes, you know, yeah, perhaps the fact that it wasn't introduced by, you know, all conquering Europeans who've come to plunder the tin mines or the gold or whatever it is, whatever the natural resource is. Maybe that plays its part, but it just seems such a foreign concept that even the biggest clubs in the city, are younger than my dad. You know, it blows my mind. You know, it's like, you know, I always turn around to my brother and will always say, you know, you do realise you're older than PSG, stuff like that. You know, so, you know, it always, because, you know, you expect football clubs to be at least a century old. And what I mean now, 2020s, football clubs should be at least 120 years old. You know, it's mad to think that there's a football team that, you know, of not all that long being at an age where they could have a bus pass. it's such a volatile, you know, concept and environment. I it blows my mind.
I mean, Pete, please feel free to explain to the three, no offence, lads, the three dunces at the back of the class who just don't seem to be able to grasp
this. How can you pick up a football club and shift it? You can't stop it.
And how would you ever hope to get a supporter base when you pitch up and then go off again? It's almost like a travel. It reminds you of a travelling fair. It seems to be that sort of a concept.
No, I mean, it completely is. I mean, there are certain reasons which explain it, but none of these clubs really, really embed. And you're absolutely right for the reasons why they don't. It's because, you know, they're there, you know, they don't have a link with the city. They don't have a link with the region. They don't have players that have come through the town. You know, people haven't grown up supporting them. People don't associate with them. You know, they're not the club that you first went to. You know, there's some club that used to be another club and they used to be somewhere before that. So it's not a model that works. It's one that is kind of accidental, though, in the Colombian situation. I think that there are certain things that we can look at to explain why these travelling circuses of clubs happen. And I'll give you a few more examples at the end of this, just to kind of follow this craziness, just because it's worth showing how many clubs change name and disappear. But so Colombia, like we said, Colombia has certain geographical features. You know, it's quite disconnected. The geography disconnects it. So, you know, and a lot of the transport make it hard for these cities to connect. So actually, cities kind of grow up separately and they do their own thing. But some are more successful than others. Some grow more than others and some do quite well. What also happens is that they kind of build their footballing infrastructure necessarily before the clubs are really there. Almost every stadium in Colombia is not owned by the club. There are only, I think, two. Deportivo Cali certainly do. And the other one escapes me. Can't remember if it's Pereira or somewhere like that. But very few clubs actually own their stadium. They belong to the municipality. So one of the things that happens is quite a lot of the cities in Colombia will have a football stadium. They might not always have a team there. You know, they might have amateur teams that have played there. It might be the site of university games. Originally, it was probably where the department played, the region played. That was where, you know, the kind of representatives of that area played their football. So what tends to happen is that a mayor will come in, or a local politician or a local governor for a department will come in and realize that they have a stadium but no one to play in it. And they think, why is this? Can we try and put a club there that will boost this and, you know, will become attraction, it will raise money, we can create something around it. And that's what tends to happen. So these clubs are kind of parachuted into where a stadium is. And Itagüí is a perfect example of that. You know, there have been five or six different clubs that have played in Itagüí, starting from Club Deportivo Industrial Itagüí. Then we have Águilas Doradas, who now play in Rio Negro. We have Deportivo Antioquia, and we have Itagüí Football Club. But all of those have different incarnations. So that's kind of one problem. Another problem that you also have is, I think, the kind of structure of Di Mayor, of the Colombian Professional League, was very rigid for a long time. It was kind of fixed on where people could get to. You had to be able to get there, and that probably either needed bus routes or airports. So a lot of the cities didn't originally have that. That meant that when the league first started up, El Dorado, you know, the Professional League in 1948, there were only 10 teams. But everyone started listening to this. You know, everyone's listening to the radio because it's really exciting. The newspapers are full of this professional league that is a sensation in the country. You know, you have Di Stefano, Pedernera, Nestor Rossi, Pontoni, Real. All these incredible Argentinians, Peruvians, Uruguayans, Brazilians suddenly come into Colombia, and it becomes a national obsession. You know, it's not just a thing of Cali and Bogota and Medellin and so on. The whole country is connected by radio, at least, and listening to that. So the people who grow up in those cities are listening to football about those clubs. They're not watching their own teams. They're supporting Millonarios or América de Cali or Junior de Barranquilla because that's who they hear and that's somehow how they're connected. And with this kind of Colombian tradition of passing on loyalties from father to son, I mean, often it's talked about in political terms. Colombia has a long history of political violence due to being either liberals or conservatives. And it's a little bit like that with football as well. So the kind of the football heritage is passed down and they belong to these particular Colombian clubs, you know, that have been there since the 40s. You know, they're the grandes, they're the big clubs. So it's very hard for new clubs to permeate that kind of heritage, you know, particularly when, you know, they haven't got solid bases. There isn't a local kind of infrastructure that's really built those to support them. I mean, I think one thing that's worth saying about Colombia as well that is good is that in terms of South American countries, a lot more clubs in a lot more cities have won the Colombian League. You know, Argentina, you know, is Buenos Aires, La Plata, which is near Buenos Aires, Avellaneda, which is practically Buenos Aires anyway, you know, and Rosario, I suppose. Uruguay is Montevideo and nothing else. Asunción is Paraguay, you know. But Colombia, you know, you have the two teams we've talked about, Santa Fe and Millonarios winning the league. In Cali, you've got Deportivo Cali in America. Nacional and Medellin in Medellin. You've got Junior in Barranquilla. You've got a club from Boyacá, which is not a particularly big area, who have won the league. Quindío have won the league. Caldas and Manizales have won the league. And a lot of clubs do very well. You know, so there are clubs that have been around for, you know, a fairly long time, haven't really been big, but have done quite well. Tolima being another one. So that's what does make it interesting. But, you know, but you do have this roundabout of when they tried to create a second division. So, you know, why don't we have a second division? We only have the Premier League, the Liga A, and then we have the amateur leagues, effectively. They tried to create a second division in the early 90s. And they're really creating clubs from scratch. So a lot of the financial, you know, a lot of the infrastructure you need to create a club wasn't there. You know, the loyalties aren't there. The, you know, the ownership of the club, the history of how to run it aren't there. They're owned by businessmen that are trying to make money. And when they can't make money very quickly, they flog it off to somewhere else. And this is how you get this situation of, we need to have a second division, but the clubs are failing economically. So they sell it on for someone else to have a go. And then you get these situations like Tigres or, I mean, again, there's a club called, let's go with Córdoba. Let's give the example of a club that started in Córdoba, which is kind of the northeast of the country. They start there. Then it becomes Atlético de la Sabana, and that's in Sincelejo, similar region. Then they go up to the Caribbean and become Uni Autónoma. They do reasonably well, actually gets the Premier, the first division for a while. But then they disappear to be replaced by Orso Marzo, who are a team who play in Palmira, which you may remember where Expreso Rojo, who then became Tigres, also played. So you see how it kind of works. And there's lots of other examples. Atletico Bello become Atletico Juventud. They play in Soacha again, much like Expreso Rojo, who then became Tigres, also did for a while and played in Soacha. They then move to Girardot, which is in a different department altogether. Then they go back to Soacha again. They then go to Fortaleza, who did play in Bogota for a while. So Fortaleza were another brief Bogota club. But they've just moved outside Bogota to a place called Cota. And actually hit the headlines nationally very recently for coming out of the tunnel for the start of their game with sunglasses and all wearing capes. So if Fortaleza don't have fan groups and they don't have a stadium, they've moved every 3 years. At least they've got a little bit of fashion sense when they come out to start the game.
So there you go, Gary. Your thoughts on that little lesson, and how and who you're going to repeat that to tomorrow?
Well, I tell you what, I did remember we had a pod with the guy's name escapes me, who wrote a book called "Who Ate All the Squid," in his first football in South Korea, and it wasn't dissimilar. Cities that had big stadiums were enticing clubs to go there, you know, and mayors were being elected on almost like a promise, well, we'll get a football club here, and that sort of thing. I mean, it's strange, the sort of similarity there. Another club I came across, which has a sort of similar travel, what Peter's been described, is a club called Bogota FC. And they've had several names in their brief existence: Club El Condor, Condor El Bogota, Condor Deportivo Sir Bogota. Apparently, I don't know, 10 years or so ago, they announced they were going to leave the city to move to a city in the Cordoba region. And so they sort of cut all their ties with the city and then found out it wasn't actually going to happen and had to go back. I mean, so you've sort of hacked off all of the, you know, any fans that you've got, any fan loyalty that you've got, and then said, sorry, guys, we're actually back here. I mean, it just seems such a wow, crazy situation. But, you know, I fully understand what, you know, the description that Pete gives and the reason for it. And I say it's so, it rings familiar with the, it's Devin, wasn't it? Devin, the guy who wrote the book, who had all the squid.
And Tony Rich.
Sorry?
Yeah, no, you're right, Gary, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
It's so similar to the situation he described in South Korea. These two countries, I mean, different hemispheres, or the different parts of the world that have a sort of a similar situation, that where smaller clubs become like PR stunts almost for political purposes for them, you know, the local mayors and promotion of, they're trying to promote their own city. Fascinating, Pete, absolutely fascinating.
It is, and I guess, Stephen, it's there's no wonder, but obviously it can't be healthy for football in Colombia. It can't be healthy for football, you know, in Bogota. And I suppose you're caught, you know, you really are, or Colombian football certainly in the big cities. It's so caught between wanting to have more options, more choice, more support, more just more football, you know, to be better for the game. But then, if it's always going to be like this, all you're ever going to bring is heartache, upset, confusion, disillusion. It's, you know, you're torn between, yes, we want you to do it, we want you to try, and look, just stop trying because this isn't working. It's the ultimate catch 22 situation.
It is. It's almost like you're being funneled into supporting one of the two big clubs who share a stadium. You know, it's not even like, you know, you go to your big Clasico or whatever you want to call it in this instance, and then you're going into the burr pit of your big rivals, and you go. It's a bit like the Milans in that respect, sharing a stadium, and you know, you don't even have that class division. You know, the both clubs that came from a, you know, reasonably privileged background, so you can't even have that pantomime of, here's the working class club, here is the upper class club, you know, here is the haves and the have nots. It doesn't exist. You know, this seems like a really, you know, yes, it's a you know, an unstable environment as far as kind of like smaller clubs are concerned. Yet with the biggest clubs, there is no variation as such. There is no gulf between the two. You know, you look at the clubs, and unless you've got to imagine that unless it's a family tradition, and you thou shalt support Millonarios, or you thou shalt support Santa Fe, then, you know, if you're going to pick your football team and you've not got that, you know, you've not got that kind of like decision already made for you, then what is your decision informed upon? You know, is it the toss of a coin?
It's a great shout, and I was just about to ask Pete that as well. I guess this sort of almost lack of social identity for these two clubs in terms of, you know, like you say, whether it's a cause, whether it's a belief, whether it's your social standing, whether it's your club, whatever it is, like Stephen said there, that draws you to a club. Is that an exception in Colombian football, or is that the norm?
I think what's really interesting, I think that there are certain subtleties, but I think there's also reasons why there is almost, because of the historical circumstances, there's kind of a reason why there isn't a sense of binary opposition, particularly between Santa Fe and Millonarios. So I think that there's a little bit of very quick history that kind of goes on here. So Colombia, we know about a lot of the violence. You know, Colombia has a reputation for violence. A lot of it now has been associated with either drug cartels or the FARC, the kind of the guerrilla organization. Before that, though, the, you know, really since independence, Colombia's divided into really two political parties, the Liberals and Conservatives. And there's been a long history of wars, you know, throughout, you know, the 19th and 20th centuries. One of the really worst ones appeared so bad for Colombia that it's called La Violencia, the violence. Happens in 1948. It's what happens is a guy called Jorge Eliezer Gaitan, who is a liberal leader, is assassinated in Bogota. And really, the Bogota explodes. You know, there is a kind of outbreak of political violence between liberals and conservatives, both trying to kill each other. And this kind of spreads, and it becomes really a civil war that takes place really in a lot of the countryside. There is a deliberate attempt to stop it kicking off in the cities. And actually, football is a part of this. So there is a little bit of, there is a kind of identification with Millonarios with being linked to conservatism. They play in blue. One of the major kind of figures in the kind of the successful formation and building of the club before the professional era was known to be conservative. Some of the other links to the family had conservative links due to the, you know, the elite nature of the club. Santa Fe also had a couple of, they play in red and white. That's actually after Arsenal, but red is the colour of the Liberal Party. And there were some of the directors of Santa Fe who had affiliations with the Liberals. But one of the things that was really, really important for the start of the Professional Football League, which happened only several months after the assassination of Jorge Eliezer Gaitan and this outbreak of violence, the Professional Football League is kind of rushed into operation. It happens, I think, three or four months after this assassination. The violence started. And football becomes a way of trying to pacify the country, like saying, right, we need something that is not political, it's not binary, it is entertainment, and will distract the attraction. And football does become this pacification device in lots of ways. And I think that football is very depoliticized. It's any kind of political concept or that kind of identity, binary, oppositional construct is really deliberately taken away. It's not exacerbated in the press. If anything, this is where culture is. This is where gentlemanly behavior, this is where values are. This is not brutality, internecine political violence. I mean, actually, one of the academic articles I'm hoping to write in the next few months is actually going to talk about how the press do this, how they say, look, you know, with all this terrible violence going on in the country and this history of violence, we can learn something from football and what this gives the country. So that in many ways is why we don't have very distinct identities that Stevie talks about really correctly. You know, they're not coming from the poor quarter or whatever. A lot of the fans will come from the poor classes now, you know, but, you know, the poor areas of Bogota. The other thing that's worth knowing about why you don't have determined areas of Bogota supporting Millonarios or Santa Fe is that Bogota has become a city that has had a real influx of domestic migration because of La Violencia in the 40s and 50s and because of the violence of the FARC and the paramilitaries and, you know, and the state violence that's going on. A lot of people have been forcibly displaced and have come to Bogota. So these are people that have not been in Bogota for their whole lives. Their family didn't necessarily grow up there. You know, they probably lived in different parts of the country in rural areas. They worked as farmers or whatever, and then end up in Bogota because there's nowhere else to go. So, and then they pick a club probably because of who they like or who's doing well or which footballer they quite like. So it's a really different reason. There isn't that kind of identity starting point. It's very loose, but it's deliberately downplayed in many ways. The violence that is between Santa Fe and Millonarios fans is down to the passions of the club and just kind of that rivalry between we are Santa Fe, you are Millonarios, we fight because we're oppositions. Colombia is a country of lots of oppositions. It's one of its biggest problems. It's very binary, you know, and there's been a lot of regional disputes as well. I think that in some of the other cities, there are slightly more reasons for supporting them. I mean, for supporting a particular club. You know, we did a pod about América de Cali, which I'm not sure will be out by the time this one comes out. But that club, América, has slightly more links with certain working class identities than Deportivo Cali does. But yeah, there isn't that political affiliation. There aren't religious connotations. There aren't, you know, you are the south of the city, we are the north, and you know, and that's kind of the historical and cultural reasons why that particular rivalries or particular identities aren't associated with Santa Fe and Mionaris in any case.
Again, you know, Gary, I guess, you know, it kind of answers the question and then some. When you think there's only, I'll say only two clubs, obviously the you know, the two large clubs that sort of sit astride the city, and yet there is still so much social, cultural turmoil, story, history, context, you know, all the things that you want to cause it. And I suppose I come back to the point that it seems to be Colombian football, first of all, but then Bogota itself seems to be such a contradiction. You would assume that it's such a relatively straightforward situation that Bogota finds itself in with regards to football, and yet it's incredibly complicated.
And it just, I mean, for me, you know, we've all sort of political hat on. I mean, this is absolutely fascinating, and it struck me that when Pete was talking about the after the Valencia, Mark said that religion was the opium of the masses. By telling Colombia that football was the opium of the warring classes at that time, and you know, fascinating. Also, it was interesting, you know, when Pete said about the makeup of Bogota and so many people coming to from agricultural areas, and there's a sort of very a similarity over here in Spain in post the Spanish Civil War, the poor regions like Andalusia lost the rural people there, sort of left the countryside to go into the cities, and it's why you find that in Barcelona, the third and fourth most popular clubs in Barcelona are Sevilla and Betis, Real Betis, because it's the people who move from Sevilla and the surrounding areas from Andalusia to find work in the big cities. That you know, it's amazing how these sort of social, political, cultural movements are sort of replicated in different parts of the world. Absolutely, you know, as I said, for somebody, you know, with sort of my sort of political approach. I mean, absolutely stunningly fascinating. Brilliant, stunningly brilliant.
It absolutely is. It is stunningly brilliant. You know, like I say, it's fascinating to listen to. In terms of, you know, I guess, you know, Stephen, this is something we've chatted about a little bit before, but it's not be careful of what you wish for, but, you know, we sort of, sometimes we look on with envious eyes at South America and the chaos and the passion and the, you know, and the, it tends to be lacking from European football, or, you know, potentially the UK game. But it's also, like I say, you've got to be careful what you wish for. Do you want, you know, as sort of, you know, football fans, as you talked about, you know, with tradition and clubs that have always been, you know, some grounds have been where they were built from day one on the same site, you know, clubs that are 100, 120 years old, you know, would you trade that stability, that history for that chaos, that unpredictability, that passion and that intensity? I'm not sure.
I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't swap being the supporter of the club I am. Not just because of what they've done while I've been on this planet. You know, it's just simply because of that historical context, that generational thing. You know, it was handed to me by my dad. You know, he took me along, and, you know, that was the club that he was inspired by in the 50s. You know, he could have chose Everton. You know, he wasn't given that. You know, his dad wasn't a huge football fan. He just went along with his mates, and, you know, he'd go to Anfield one weekend, he'd go to Goodison the next, and it was the team in red that, you know, he just felt more a kinship to. So, you know, it's that handing down of the generation. Well, I was 2021. So we're going back to kind of like 70 years. You know, my sport is 70 years in the making as such. Now, if I hand that on to my kids, they will take it beyond the 100-year mark. So, you know, that's what it is to me. You know, football has that historical context. So that's why I find it such a foreign concept to see clubs shifted from pillar to post, from city to city, to have this nomadic existence, even to the point that, you know, if there's a football club that's had five or six grounds, I frown a bit. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, clubs that hand over the, you know, the legendary stadiums for a, you know, for a Meccano Identikit stadium on an out of town retail park, you know, bothers me greatly. You know, I'm sure Pete must, you know, sorely miss the Dell. You know, for all its, you know, its rusticness. You know, I was lucky enough to go to the Dell. Friends in Southampton, I used to adore going to Southampton at my, you know, spend the weekend there, go to the Dell, watch the game, just make a weekend of it. Absolutely adore the place. St Mary's was never the same. You know, it's that sense of soul that I look for in football. And you know, that is something that must be lost to a team that is just, you know, it morphs and it regenerates into a different name and a different place, shifted to a different ground. Now, how can you possibly gain that attachment, you know, in the same respect, you know, so I've said before about that trip to Japan I did and you know, Viva and Nagasaki, you know, so, and seeing the support and the passion that supporters can have for what is a relatively new identity. But, you know, I think that's a bit different in respect that I can't see that football club going anywhere different to where it is geographically. You know, it might be a newish football entity, but it's going to be, you know, rooted within its community for decades, hopefully centuries to come. You know, we're talking about, especially away from the main two here in Bogota, you know, who knows where they'll be playing in 5 years' time? How can you, you know, consciously attach your support to something that might not be there, you know, in a very short space of time?
Can just come back briefly, Stu, for a second?
Yeah, of course.
Something struck me while Steve was talking. It's something Pete mentioned about me and Eros wear blue and Santa Fe wear red. And it's sort of fascinating if you think of other clubs and cities where that similar difference, red and blue, applies. So you've got Everton, Liverpool, obviously, City United. In Milan, you've got the Rossoneri and the Nerazzurri, so the blue and blacks and the red and blacks. In the Basque Country, you have the Athletic Club, who play in red and white, and Sociedad, who play in blue and white. I mean, not in the same city, but it's in the, you know, it's part of the Basque Country. Barcelona, the Blaugrana, so the red and blue of Barcelona, the blue of Espanyol. I mean, I'm just interested that, you know, although they aren't politically defined, in fact, very much sort of politically neutral but created to be that. It's just fascinating how much that red and blue change. I mean, even in North London, Arsenal, white and red, Tottenham, white and blue. Amazing how many times that sort of straight, same difference crops up.
It is, they are your, it's funny, I was thinking about this, I can't remember why I was thinking about it. I was thinking about it the other day, and red and blue are really the two colours that you associate with football when you're, you know, different teams picking colours, whether it's bibs, whatever it is, it's red and blue. And you're absolutely right, Gary. You know, red and blue are the colours.
But red or blue, perhaps, rather than
yeah, red. Yeah, yeah, sorry, yeah. Unless you're Barca, but yeah. It's, obviously, Pete, you know, we have our sort of sections that we go through here, and one of them's local derbies, which obviously clearly is a given. But, you know, and I suppose this all, you know, these two next points will tie in together, I guess, and that's, A, the success of Independiente Santa Fe and, you know, Mianares, you know, which is the most successful club domestically and continentally. And then, you know, I suppose which one is the dominant club? You know, has there always been a dominant club or, you know, or has it very much been as football, you know, tends to go? And, you know, and Stephen mentions it a lot about how football, you know, comes in cycles and waves. And, you know, and it is that, you know, both teams had their moments and their share of the spotlight, or has one always superseded the other?
Yeah, I think that in terms of pure trophies, Millonarios have the upper hand. You know, they have won more league titles. They've probably had the greater teams that have impacted internationally. Santa Fe will always have the pride of place of saying that they won the first Colombian professional league. They will then point out having in 2017 that their women's team also achieved the same thing. They also won the first women's professional league. So Santa Fe will proudly say that they are the original winners. You know, that's one of the things they will boast about. Millonarios, though, you know, resonate much more, I suppose, in terms of the greatness. You know, in terms of a club that really created a massive impression, not just nationally but continentally. And this is the team of the El Dorado Perú we've mentioned before. And just very briefly, a quick bit of context: there is a, you know, at the same time as La Violencia, the, you know, the professional league starts, and there is also a players' strike the following year in Argentina and Uruguay. And Colombian clubs take advantage of these, realise that the clubs, you know, the footballers aren't playing, and offers them contracts. And Millonarios are the team that starts it. They've got this, probably one of the greatest figures, visionary figures of arguably South American football. A guy called Alfonso Senior is the director of Millonarios. And he sends the coach, Cacho Alave, to Argentina and says, look, get me a player. And Alave comes back with Alfonso Pedernera, who is one of the Máquina. He was one of the great Máquina team of the 40s of River Plate. And this is an absolute sensation. You know, this is an absolute, it's like, you know, it's like Messi turning up and playing for, you know, for some Finnish team or something similar. It's that kind of impact. You know, one of the greatest players in the continent who's renowned, suddenly playing for a country that's only had a professional league for a year, playing in a country that's only had a professional year, a year of professional football. There's actually a headline which says something like, Colombia tiene pedernitis, Colombia gets pedernitis. Like this, imagine this kind of illness of everyone suddenly absolutely obsessed by hearing about Pedernera and really excited about it. And anyway, Pedernera is the genesis of what becomes the Ballet Azul football team, the Blue Ballet. Millonarios realise that this is a money spinner. They go and buy Di Stefano, they go and buy Nestor Rossi, one of the great midfield generals. They go and buy a guy called Julio Cotzi, who is known as the goalkeeper of the century in Argentina, one of their greatest goalkeepers. And then every other club starts doing the same. Santa Fe are trying to do the same as well, but they don't quite have the same level of success as Millonarios do. Millonarios really dominate the El Dorado period. They win three of the next four leagues before the El Dorado period finishes. It's in this period, Stevie mentioned a bit earlier about, you know, British players being signed to play for Santa Fe. I might leave that for one of the others to talk about if, you know, they want. But there's several players that come from England to Colombia, which again is a sensation. You know, players coming from the home of football to play in our country. Surely Colombian football now is one of the best in the world. That's how it's seen. But anyway, Millonarios dominate this period. They actually go and play in a 50-year tournament, a 50-year anniversary tournament in Spain. They play against Real Madrid, they play against Norrköping, Swedish club, and they play against Sevilla. And Millonarios beat Real Madrid 4-2. And the ambassador to Spain says, these footballers, this team, has achieved more for Colombian foreign policy in one game than we have done in three decades. Yeah, this is the impact it has. It puts Colombian football on the map. The only problem is there's no Colombian football about it. You know, there's two footballers, a guy called Francisco Cobo Zuluaga, who was a very fine centre-back, and then the reserve goalkeeper, Gabriel Ochoa Uribe, who becomes one of the most famous coaches for Millonarios and América down the line. But this is the first great Millonarios team, and then Millonarios, again, are really successful in the 60s. There's a guy called Delio, the Marvel Gamboa, who becomes a bit of an icon. There's a guy called Marino Klinger, who, again, is an extremely successful footballer in a kind of Colombian context. But also, that was around the same period as Colombia qualified for the World Cup in 1962 for the first time. The 70s, Millonarios, again, strong, a team comprising a guy called Alejandro Brand, Willington Ortiz, probably until Valderrama, Colombia's greatest footballer, was a very successful winger and scorer of goals, Jaime Morón. Santa Fe's success is a little bit more intermittent. They've again done pretty well. But you can't see, I suppose, a period of sustained success, apart from really in the early years of the 2010s, when they win the league in 2012, 2014 and 2016. Prior to that, they're kind of every 5 or 6 years, they'll have a good run, they'll win the league. They've obviously, both clubs have had lots of, you know, famous players, but probably only in a Colombian context. They've lacked that kind of breakout superstar. But, you know, both teams have had periods of success. I suppose that there is a big hole in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s for both clubs, actually. That's very noticeable. There are reasons for that. It's probably mostly due to the fact that the drug benefactors of both clubs weren't quite as powerful or successful or scary as the clubs who own the cartel who owned América de Cali or Atlético Nacional. So in lots of ways there, I think Millonarios certainly can be accused of being a sleeping giant. They haven't had the success in recent years that, you know, a club of their stature really should have had. And again, neither club has really strongly impacted internationally. You know, they haven't won the Libertadores. Santa Fe have won the Sudamericana in 2015 in their probably strongest period, consistent period in their history. But Millonarios were unfortunate in the fact that in their greatest period, there was no Copa Libertadores.
I guess there you go then, Gary. That sort of sums up nicely and succinctly for us with lots of detail with regards to success. And again, you know, success is such a subjective thing. You know, is it about, you know, players that you produce? Is it about players that you contribute to the national team? Is it about trophies won? Is it about heritage history? Is it about fan base? You know, it's such a difficult question to sort of answer. But again, Pete sort of absolutely nailed it and then some, with a whole range of different criteria depending on how we feel like measuring success. I feel like he's given us an answer for every avenue.
Just a bit, Mike, just a bit. It's interesting Pete mentioned about that Santa Fe won the Copa Sudamericana in 2015. It was in 2015 that they were actually ranked as the best team in South America. It just seemed massively interesting in as much as, you know, they've never won the Copa Libertadores at all. And, you know, interesting point. Just going back to what Pete was saying about the El Dorado era and the influx of players from Argentina, the strike there, and one of those was Di Stefano that moved to Millonarios. And the transfer went Spanish clubs were interested in signing Di Stefano. There was a real interesting way that, well, problems that about it, because FIFA didn't recognise the transfers as being valid. So Real Madrid, basically, two that Pete mentioned, went to Millonarios and agreed a deal to buy Di Stefano, signed Di Stefano. Barcelona went to River and agreed a deal to sign Di Stefano. So basically, FIFA said that Di Stefano, because Colombia were performing outside of FIFA edict, that the transfer to Millonarios was invalid and he was still a River player. So Barcelona legally, well, in FIFA terms, had the transfer. And this was what led to the massive problem that Di Stefano actually played in one season. He actually played for both clubs. And the Spanish FA actually tried to resolve the issue by saying, OK, well, you'll have to play for one club one season and the other club the other season. In the end, Barcelona conceded that, you know, if the guy didn't want to play for us, he didn't want to play for us, and he went to Real Madrid. But this is sort of the sort of problems that came out because of the Colombian setup and operating outside FIFA. I think they even got banned by FIFA from the World Cup because of this. The strange sort of the consequences of transfers of those days, and or non-transfers as they were perhaps deemed to be by FIFA.
It was very much Pirate League. It was known as a Pirate League for a long time. Yeah.
Sorry, something that we started off with, Stephen, and that sort of, you know, right at the beginning, we talked about sort of, you know, the clubs scene, the domestic scene in Uruguay and Brazil and Argentina, and the names of the clubs. And, you know, as Pete was saying there, I guess that no Copa Libertadores win probably is a major factor in why, you know, and I include, again, as always, I include myself in this first before I tar anybody else with this brush, but maybe why these clubs are not on the radar of European fans as much as these Brazilian sides, Argentine sides and Uruguayan sides. It's almost like, you know, there needs to be continental success before they enter the consciousness of most European football fans.
Yes, I think we've said many times is that how our geography, our grasp of geography has been greater enhanced by, you know, our knowledge of football. And, you know, if certain places aren't on the footballing map, then we miss them geographically. almost. You know, I know kind of like Wiltshire is an absolute mystery zone to me, apart from one trip to Swindon. You know, it's stuff like that. You know, the southeast in particular of England is a totally mysterious zone that I've never really ventured into, simply because I don't think Liverpool have ever passed through knowingly. you know, certainly not for a game I've been to. But, you know, you look at Bogota, and I think one of the most telling thing is that there's very few footballers of massive repute that have emanated from the city. You know, yes, we can point to Millonarios and the El Dorado era and Di Stefano and all of that, but they were imports that made this story possible. You know, it was the renegade nature of the league. It's the imports that do so. Bogota is just coming across as a city that isn't football generated. There will be people who love the sport, love the teams, and all of that, but it doesn't seem to evoke enough passion to be called a hotbed of football, almost. You know, where are the legends? Where are the players that have risen to become, you know, globally known? You know, when you look at kind of, you know, notable people from Bogota, what's quite noticeable is that, you know, a lot of fashion designers pop up, a lot of artists, musicians. You know, there seems to be something of bohemian nature to at least part of Bogota that is down to artistic creativity rather than sporting endeavour. You know, the finest sporting son is Juan Pablo Montoya. You know, it's someone behind the wheel of very fast cars. You know, they have a few famous cyclists that have done quite well. You know, it is just one of these areas that seems to, it doesn't generate that adoration for football enough for kids to be able to step up and be that next big star. You know, where is the Maradona that's come from the shanty town? You know, for as far as Bogota is concerned, that player does not exist.
You're absolutely right, and you've kind of killed the last question, I'm not going to lie. So the last question is famous players that have come from the
city. Quick, rethink, Stu, rethink.
So what I'll do is we'll re-edit. No, so in terms of, I guess then, is we'll slightly rephrase the question, because, you know, Stephen's absolutely right. You can't change history just because we happen to have a question. In terms of, you know, for you, Pete, obviously, you know, famous managers, coaches, you know, players that have come from these clubs. But I guess it's probably worth mentioning, seems to be mentioned, whether, you know, Stephen's sort of said it brilliantly there, you know, is it more of a, almost like a passing through place, almost like a town in the Wild West? It's not a destination. It's just a stop off point. So, you know, in terms of players who maybe come from there, you know, maybe it's more players who have passed through there and potentially left an imprint.
Yeah, I think that's a really good description of what it is. You know, it's a passing through spot for Colombian footballers who may get signed by Santa Fe or Millonarios, and then will go elsewhere to have their renowned success. You know, then they'll go to, traditionally the roots are Argentinian or maybe Brazilian football. And then from the 90s onwards, then you can make it to Europe. You know, there are a couple of different paths now. Mexican football to the US is another path to hopefully the European leagues. So, yeah, you, what you have in Colombia is, in a moment of, there was a reason for doing this for my master's degree. I looked at where Colombian footballers came from, you know, where was it, and was football really represented the country? There are something like four people who've played for Colombia who are from Bogota. One of the most famous is Abel Aguilar. He played in the World Cup, you know, in the 2014. He was one of the centre midfielders who did all the donkey work while James Rodriguez was busy being legendary. Edwin Congo, who randomly went to Real Madrid, never played, but had one spectacular season in Colombia, then went to Real Madrid, was another one. one of the greatest idiots of Colombian football, Eduardo Pimentel, who is now the manager of the director of Boyacá Chico, and just a colossal idiot of the highest order. Famous for being, you know, argumentative, a real midfield sending off, red card waiting to happen. Such an idiot that he refused to pay the women who had laundered and made the kit for his club, refused to pay them the money that she was owed. He's also from Bogota, played a little bit. But I think that in Colombia, a lot of the greatest players come from the coast. You know, they come from the Caribbean coast and they come from the Pacific coast. That's where, you know, yeah, you do find the poverty. You maybe have the natural fitness and athleticism if we're looking for those kind of reasons. Someone like, you know, Valderrama is from Santa Marta. Willington Ortiz, the great player of the 70s, you know, Colombia's greatest type, again, is from the Pacific coast. And a lot of them are. Some of the players that you will probably have heard of that have passed through Santa Fe Millonarios. Santa Fe was where Jerry Mina made an impact before he went to Palmeiras. We could look at Adolfo El Tren Valencia, who played for Bayern Munich, again, a player of that 1990s, 94 generation. Great player for Santa Fe. If we go back, you know, back a long time, we have several British figures. Charlie Mitten was a Man United player who was signed by Santa Fe in 1950, I think. Alongside Neil Franklin, it was a centre-half who was at Stoke City, looked like he was going to be the next great British centre-half, went to Santa Fe, didn't last, came back, really never got accepted. George Mountford was another one who I think was at Stoke and went to Santa Fe. In the case of Millonarios, some of the other figures that we could mention who, you know, have hit the headlines, I think I've already talked about Maravilla Gamboa, one of the first Colombian players who made it in Mexico. That was a real important moment for Colombian football. Going back into the late 70s and early 80s, Arnaldo Iguarán in Colombian football was a hero. He was the Colombian leading scorer for a long time until Radamel Falcao beat his record. Scored 120 odd goals for Millonarios and 25 goals for Colombia when they weren't good. You know, he was the goal scoring threat. But really, the problem with a lot of the two Bogota clubs is that they don't really have the reputation for being hubs of youth football. You know, they're not renowned for that. There are clubs in the Caribbean that do it very well. Medellin do it very well. There's a club called Envigado, who definitely have a reputation for producing young players. The likes of James Rodriguez came from there. But Millonarios and Santa Fe, not so much. They tend to be, you know, a club that tries to poach from somewhere else or tries to sign someone from someone else. But even that now doesn't happen because, you know, the scouting system is so good in South America that if someone is good at 18, you know, and they've grown up in a particular city and are doing well, you know, they'll be off to Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, the US, you know, before they've even had a chance to go to Santa Fe or Millonarios. And that explains possibly why these two clubs, or why Millonarios anyway, haven't had the success that their name and their heritage might suggest.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, Gary, that, you know, you have this, you know, and Pete, you know, Pete mentioned again at the beginning, you know, certainly with Argentina and Uruguay, how football is very sort of concentrated in two or three, you know, major cities. And that's part of the geography of the country, it's part of the geography of the continent. But then when you get to those cities, you then have this raft of names that sort of come through the history of the game and the, you know, whether it's with the national team or with the clubs. But, you know, as Pete mentioned there again, and we, you know, we mentioned this right at the beginning, Colombia and, you know, and in particular Bogota is such an anomaly with what you expect the norm to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's when I was doing my research this morning, I was looking for famous players from Bogota. Couldn't find any. I mean, it was really like, you know, as dry as the Sahara Desert. And I was thinking, well, either I'm doing something wrong here or perhaps there weren't that many. And I didn't really know why, but what Pete's just said probably does give a reason or justification why perhaps, as you mentioned, clubs in Bogota are seen as like a transit camp. Players go there and then they go on to other places in Brazil or Argentina or perhaps Mexico and then the United States or Brazil, Argentina, and then into Europe. You know, there again, and you know, as Pete explained there, it's perhaps another reason why the big clubs, these two big clubs in Bogota, you know, Mianeros and Santa Fe, haven't had the continental success that, you know, we would perhaps associate with the finest names that they are.
You know, Stephen, you know, you and I, you know, the sort of, and I would imagine a lot of sort of European fans, it's, you know, obviously, where am I going with this? Sorry, until relatively recently with football saturation, but, you know, sort of, you know, the 80s, 90s, your knowledge of Colombian football to a certain extent was the national team, and that was it. You know, there was no real comprehension of the domestic scene behind, you know, those national team players. It was all very much they arrive, you know, these players arrive, it's very exotic, it's very South American, and then they disappear, and you don't know what they're disappearing back to. You have no idea what they're going back to. And then they just come again 4 years later and they're still same players, same characteristics, same style of football. But those intervening 4 years, you have no clue of any of this background.
No, and the fact that, you know, for us, Colombia didn't tip up until 1990. So, you know, we've already got our preconceived ideas of South American football entrenched by that. You know, we've seen our first couple of World Cups. You know, it's all about Brazil, it's all about Argentina. You know, there's a bit of Peru in there, Uruguay, Chile. You know, Colombia are nowhere near. Even Paraguay have got to the 1986 World Cup. And, you know, Colombia are, I suppose, widely seen as one of the whipping boys. Maybe, you know, not quite an Ecuador or a Venezuela, but, you know, closer in relation to those than they are, certainly, to even the mid-range in South American teams. You know, anyone, I don't think even anyone of my generation quite realised that Colombia had even fumbled the 1986 World Cup until much later on. You know, I think that came to as quite a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, you know, that was, you know, a thing. So, yes, you know, within that respect, you know, hats off to Colombia for me as being one of those, the very latest in being somewhat mysterious, you know, in the fact that football became less and less mysterious because suddenly, you know, more access to games, more access to information, the internet comes along, you know, everyone knows a bit about everything. You know, that when we've said before about Eastern European teams before the Iron Curtain came down and they had that sense of mystery to them. And that went because down came the Iron Curtain. You know, the best players flooded to the West. They tipped up in the biggest leagues, the biggest teams, not even the biggest teams, sometimes the mid-ranging ones scrapping for relegation. So suddenly, you know, everyone was familiar. And then there's you know, a Colombia. And I think, you know, Venezuela is the same now, Ecuador until relatively recently. You know, anything that has that sense of mystery to it, that, you know, you don't know something, then it needs to be cherished.
I absolutely agree that mystery of the unknown is still so...
It's such a rare thing. That's the thing about it. So when anything like that tips up, it shouldn't be feared. It should be embraced. You know,
because it won't last for long.
Because you just don't get much of that anymore.
It is. So... We're just about to leave Bogota. Gary's sorting out the tickets. But obviously, before we leave, should the worst happen and I have to leave the three of you behind, how, or not so much how, but who are you taking to your heart? Where's your money going on your season ticket? Where are you spending your, I want to say Saturday afternoons, but where are you spending your match days? If I have to abandon you all in Bogota for the rest of your life. Gary, we'll start with you first this time.
Well, I gave a hint earlier. I would go to La Equidad and support the insurance guys because I just think the nickname's fantastic. And it's interesting that they share a stadium, the Metropolitano de Tejo, with Bogota FC. But if I'm an Equidad fan, I ain't going to worry too much of that because Bogota will be off somewhere. Anytime soon. So yeah, I will go with that. I'll go with the insurance guys because, you know, if they don't play very well, I'm always proclaiming.
Stephen, I'll come with you. Where are you? Are you with Gary, with the insurance guys, or are you going elsewhere?
I'm in the same stadium, different team. And having said that, you know, it will be such a struggle to, you know, give you back into a team that might not be there next week. I am drawn to Bogota FC simply because of the absolutely excellent football shirt. You know, it's yellow with a red sash. You know, and I'm drawn by the sash on the shirt.
Big lover of the sash. You are a big lover of the sash.
Be it Peru, you know, River Plate, that sash across the shirt is just a wonderful thing. And the fact that this is so unusual, it's a yellow shirt with a red sash. It's, you know, I'm going to Bogota FC if only to buy the shirt.
That's all right. The reason why you go, it just does not matter. And had I known that they had a sash, I would have probably been able to guess straight away. If I'd known there was a sash involved, it would have been nailed on. Pete, for you?
See, this is tricky, because I've already been abandoned in Colombia on a couple of occasions. You know, and I've obviously picked... I have a Colombian team. It's America de Cali. I mean, and I've been to Bogota. I did a lot of my field work in Bogota. You know, Equidad, I would be tempted by for a lot of the reasons that Gary's talked about. The problem is that, I mean, you've got, the great thing is you've got literally the whole stadium to pick from when you go there. a mate of mine, Carl Warswick, who I thoroughly enjoy, employ you to read his articles and follow me on Twitter. Carl Warswick writes really well on Colombian football, a lot of stories. He often goes along to the techo along with 20 other people, you know, 12 of whom are the ball boys. But Equidad at least have kind of got a sense of permanence. You know, they seem to have pretty much got established there, even if nobody goes to watch them. I think that I am going to go along to Santa Fe, which is a little bit, you know, not what I would normally do. But the reason is because they were the responsible for one of the greatest bits of great fan humour that I've seen. And it was actually in relation to América de Cali. So basically, I went to watch América against Santa Fe in 2017. It was the first season America were back in the first division after they'd been relegated. Hopefully you can listen to a podcast we did about that. But basically America were in danger of being relegated, and a lot of the newspapers were talking about the fear of going down to the B and the phantasma, this kind of the ghost of this fear of the ghost of the B, the spectre of the B was hanging over America. So anyway, what the Santa Fe did, fans did at the start of the game was amazing. You know, the stadium's absolutely full, it's rocking, and the Guardia Albia Roja Sur, the big bar of Santa Fe, had this huge flag that absolutely covered the whole of their part of the stand for, you know, about 2 minutes. And you could see kind of like it ruffling. And then it kind of rolled up and disappeared, and underneath they'd changed. And they had the Ghostbusters logo. You know, they'd actually dressed so that they depicted the Ghostbusters logo. And portrayed themselves as, you know, like obviously the joke with America afraid, we're the Ghostbusters, we're going to beat you guys. And it was just such an amazingly, brilliantly coordinated moment and so brilliantly done that, you know, and I was really lucky enough to interview one of the Barra leaders of that Barra who told me about it and how they went about it. And because they invited me to their club and were good lads when I sat in their cellar social and talked to them about it, I think I'd probably have to head along to Santa Fe and join them.
I can't argue with any of your choices. The good news is I'll know where to find you all, should I ever have to come back and pick you up. But at least I'll know where to find you all. Guys, as always, like I say, it's been another incredible episode, if not just for just the crazy scenario that is football in Bogota. Gary, enjoyed it?
Yeah, been fantastic. Another place where the curtain's been drawn back, and we've been able to have a little peek inside and find out something about a city that we knew nothing about, football, just a city that we knew nothing about. And, you know, from what Pete said, if you do come and try and find us, the crowds at in Ateca, apparently you'll be able to find Steve and myself pretty easily. next time we're going to we come up north to Bogota from Avellaneda in Argentina, and we're going to almost go straight back to the same place, because we're going to go to the capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires. And I'll tell you what, guys, there's some decent clubs there. It's a little bit, that next episode, I mean, this has been great. It's been great because we've learned so much. Well, I've certainly learned so much that, you know, that I didn't know. But we'll be talking about some of the biggest clubs in South America next time.
Brilliant. Yeah. Stephen, obviously, again, enjoyed it. Looking forward to the next leg of the journey.
Oh, indeed. Like we always say, you know, it's always a school day. It's always a wonderful, and like this classroom, you don't want to sit at the back. You want to be up front. You know, right there with your nose pressed to the front desk. You know, it's absolute joy to do these podcasts. And when you do come and pick me up, I'll be easy to spot in that yellow shirt with the red sash.
I'll be finding you no problem. No problem at all. You know, Pete, as always, you know, it's just how you retain the knowledge is beyond me. How it all fits in there. And the pronunciations are just brilliant. I've got to say, like, you really are just unbelievable. Buenos Aires is okay. We're about at my limit with that, but we're okay for next week as well, for the next episode, so I can pronounce that one as well. Guys, like I say, thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me to sit and listen and ask the questions. All that's left for me to say is thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.